Hi, I'm Chloe McCulloch, editorial director of Building Magazine. This year is the 180th anniversary of our publication, and to mark this, we've launched the Building the Future Commission, one aspect of which looks at how we can build sustainable and desirable communities that people actually want to live in. The Commission is looking for best practice in urban design, and this is the accompanying podcast. Welcome to Building Talks, Creating Communities. New developments can face massive opposition, attacked for poor design, a lack of public services, and low quality civic space. These are the challenges we'll be tackling in this podcast by talking to built environment professionals. We'll explore their personal stories, influences, and motivations. And we'll ask, why is there so much interest in the placemaking agenda? And how can we make the places we work and live in better? So, welcome to Building Talks, Creating Communities. I'm here with Ben Flatman, architectural editor at Assemble Media Group. Ben will be with me for each episode of this podcast because over the past few weeks, he's been talking to built environment professionals about how best to create communities and the placemaking agenda. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Chloe.
So, Ben, tell us why you think this is such a relevant topic today.
Well, I think placemaking captures and covers so many different areas of the built environment. It relates to the economy, housing, the environment, and issues such as well-being and how we live in the UK today. And I think what's really interesting about placemaking is that it's a term that sort of became popular perhaps a decade ago, and its meaning has sort of evolved over time as approaches to urban design and creating new places has changed and evolved. And one of the really interesting things that I've learnt during this series is how people are actually questioning that term now and asking whether it's still appropriate. It almost implies that there's no place there. You're summoning something out of nothing almost. A lot of people are really talking about how we can enhance a sense of existing place and really build on what's there already. It's really about adding to that and helping it grow rather than coming in and imposing something completely new.
Quite a lot of the people you spoke to were very at pains to say that built environment professionals have a role, but they're also working with existing communities. And I think there was a real sense in which they didn't want to impose a vision on people, that there was a sense in which you can work with communities there. There's, I think even in one of the episodes, they talk about grassroots community groups who have their own ideas, and then it's around how professionals work with those groups. And I thought that was really interesting.
I think this really reflects a huge change that's taken place in the design community over the last few years, with a much greater emphasis on collaboration and co-design with existing communities, the need to give young people in particular, and also women, agency in the way that places are designed to make sure that they're inclusive. So there is this really big change taking place in the way that people talk about and approach design and urbanism that puts the community to the fore.
Okay, so you found your interesting topic. How did you find interesting people to talk about it?
The guests kind of presented themselves, I think, with a huge variety of experience. We have guests who are recognized authorities in terms of urban design and planning policy. We have the managing director of a global multidisciplinary consultancy. The idea is that really we have a sort of range of voices speaking from a really interesting series of perspectives.
I can't wait to get stuck in. I think what unites them all is their passion for the subject. You can really tell they love talking about this stuff, so they're really good to listen to. Okay, so let's get cracking. Tell us about your first guest.
Joe Wright, Managing Director of Perkins & Will, which is part of the DAR Group, a global multidisciplinary practice. Joe has got a huge amount of experience. She's very well known within the built environment community. What's really interesting about her perspective is that she talks a lot about large-scale urban interventions, such as the Battersea redevelopment in London. And she's also got this huge wealth of experience around how big firms approach these big issues.
Okay, so here's Ben talking to Joe Wright.
Hi, Joe. It's brilliant to have you as a guest on the podcast today. I believe that we're celebrating an anniversary today, and it's the fourth month in your current position. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, it's gone extremely quickly.
And you've also moved into a new office at the same time as starting this job as well. How has that all gone?
That's been brilliant. I feel thoroughly fortunate that Perkins & Will decided to move offices to welcome me. So I had a few weeks back at the Whitechapel building, quite a different part of London. And then, we moved in here at the end of February. And it's fabulous. It's whilst the floor plate on the face of it, look quite similar to the floor plate we occupied at the Whitechapel building, the nature of the building, the quality of daylight, the openness has allowed us to see ourselves as a business. And I think people have got a real bounce in their step. It's given us a new confidence. We're in a building where we've designed both shell and core and the fit out to our space. So it's really showcasing the amazing bandwidth of skills that we've got as a business. And in terms of the culture change that any new workplace fosters, it's exactly what the business needed.
Brilliant. Thank you, Jay. I'd just like to start by delving back into the past a little bit and talking to you about your own personal journey and your background and influences as an architect. What was it that got you interested in architecture and urban design to start with?
I guess I was one of those people who really enjoyed a broad range of subjects. So I really enjoyed art. I kind of had aspirations to go and do fine art. But I was also quite good at maths and science. And it was really intuition. I had a very strong feeling I wanted to study architecture. I didn't have any family connections. I had no direct experience. And I can remember going to a careers evening as a probably 14, 15-year-old and saying, well, I want to be an architect. And the response that I got was, you don't want to do that. Very difficult, economic cycles, recessions. And I then, I kind of, I accepted that view. And I was railroaded by my school, I guess, towards engineering. There was a lot of, as there still is, a need to diversify engineering. But at that stage, we're talking the very early 80s, a much greater need to get women into engineering. That's what I applied to do at university, chemical engineering, quite extraordinary. This is not what I want to do. Anyway, I stuck to my guns. I rang Imperial and I rang Bath and said, any chance I could change my offer from chemical engineering to architecture, which is another whole story. But anyway, that's how I ended up at Bath. So it was complete happenstance. Right. I didn't look at any... And when you look back, it's like, gosh, the course at Bath has been so material to everything that's come after. From going to work at Field & Clegg, which was at that stage probably 10 people, but based in Bath. Now, I wanted to work there because there were some very good people, Peter Clegg, for instance, teaching at the university. But the course at Bath was also pretty radical. It had Ted Happold and Michael Braun as joint heads of school. And it was very much modelled on the Arup model of multidisciplinary practice. So architects were trained alongside structural engineers and really significantly environmental engineers. And first year was a completely joint year.
I can see the themes running through.
Completely defining. Career. So when I then, many years later ended up at Arup, it's like, this feels like coming home. And in fact, there were quite a lot of old university friends who also ended up at Arup. It's relevant that the master's course at Bath back then, and still today, I'm now an external examiner there, and they are still running very much the same course. But the master's course was themed around placemaking, around master planning, around bringing groups of students together to work on a place, to create a vision of what that place might become, and then to design buildings within that place. And I think that was far less common at that stage than it is today. I think, I think that has become a theme of part two courses. But it also required us to think about place, to think about particular locations and the needs of those locations and how they might be transformed through architecture and urbanism. So that was another very formative influence.
So I'd just like to move on now to the sort of theme of the podcast, which is placemaking. And I just wanted to ask you, why is placemaking important? And what do you see as the key challenges for people seeking to create or sort of reinvigorate a sense of place?
Why is it important? You know, I think as architects and urban designers, I think we have a huge privilege, huge responsibility to make decisions that hopefully will endure for decades or longer. You know, we are, you know, there's a longevity in good design, which is also fundamental to sustainability. You know, doing things that last is incredibly important, and that, you know, that responsibility, I've always taken very seriously. I do look at, you know, some developments and wish that people had been, you know, taken their responsibilities more seriously.
Is there a sort of example of a place or an area of a city or a town that you sort of look to or refer to?
The place that I've been closest to being a part of has been Battersea. And I think that's a really interesting journey. You know, that was obviously whilst I was working with Arup, and we were appointed to take forward the Future Phases Master Plan. So essentially to rework everything that's not yet built. No, there's been a huge amount of development. If you look back at the images of Battersea in the early 2000s, you know, this extraordinary icon sitting in a kind of desert, I think what's been done there, I remember being horrified seeing it on the NLA model, but actually having spent a lot of time immersed in that site, I now find it really exciting. I think there is, you know, as an example of placemaking around a heritage asset, of transforming a significant part of London, you know, of creating a new quarter in London, of creating a new town centre for Wandsworth. I think it's a really fascinating example. I and the team that I was working with were really exposed to the difficulty of making something that significant come to pass. You know, the challenges are huge, technically, economically, in terms of dealing with the planning system. You know, the barriers to success are so many that it's almost a miracle anything ever happens.
And what changed from when you sort of joined that project in terms of changes to the Vinoli Master Plan?
Essentially, what we were doing was rethinking in the light of all the risks that were unknown unknowns at the point that Raphael started the process, changing the density in response to what, you know, what had come afterwards, you know, creating a scale of development that felt appropriate, whereas actually the Vignelli development was, although it was vast in footprint, it was kind of modest in scale. But I think there was also an appreciation from the challenges of delivering out the first phases that the grain was wrong, that it didn't sit comfortably as a part of London. And that's the challenges there are again on several different levels. There's the human experience, the ground plane experience of being able to move through space, of connections and intuitive access. There's also the development challenge of phases that were just so enormous that the kind of risks get in the way of actually bringing them forward. So there was a need to create something more granular, which actually supported, you know, in my view, supported the you know, improving the human experience.
And made it more economically viable as well, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So it was all about viability. It was about, you know, actually what we in the end secured was also a flexibility of land use, such that rather than trying to determine exactly what goes where, in a plan that's going to take another 10 years to build out, there was a, you know, within the Section 73 consent, there was an understanding that there was a kind of list of ingredients, but exactly where those ingredients need to be located was left to allow things to evolve further. So it's a more fluid consent than the original, very definitive, it will be this shape and this height and these uses. And, you know, actually, from beginning to end, it's going to have been at least a 20-year construction process, and you can't possibly know how things are going to shape up. So the lesson is to leave scope for further evolution, not to try and nail everything down.
I just wanted to skip back a little bit, because I know that you spent some time earlier in your career in Berlin, and I was just interested in hearing a little bit about your experiences there at that very particular moment in history, and how that city has informed your approaches to urbanism and placemaking.
Sure. So the Bath undergraduate course was a thin sandwich course, which created opportunities to go and try different practices for 6 months each year, which was, again, you know, an unforeseen advantage of the course that I happened to land in. And after my third year, I felt I should really go and work in a city. And I was intrigued by the idea of Berlin, which was still at that stage, you know, West Berlin. You know, the wall was still there.
So this was sort of
mid-80s. This was 1986, yeah. And so I headed off to Berlin with my extremely heavy A1 portfolio under my arm. You know, there was no internet. There was no ability to know what I might find when I got there. But I knew that there was a building exhibition happening in 1987, the International Bauausstellung.
So you didn't have a job?
No. I just set off with a portfolio and I knocked on doors. I landed in Berlin at a point at which the person at City Hall who was responsible for giving planning consents had been found taking bribes. So everything was on hold. So no one, you know, there weren't many jobs going. And I literally spent a week knocking on doors. And in the end, I knocked on a door in Uhlandstrasse. It was actually opposite Kleihus. Kleihus was the director of the IBA. I think I went to see Kleihus.
The IBA was the
International Bauausstellung. I came out of Kleihus's office and I spotted a brass plaque opposite, and it said Bartels and Schmidt Art, Architekten. I thought, well, I may as well, you know, ring that doorbell too. I had a brief conversation with Steffi Schmidt Art, and he said, "Oh, come back tomorrow when my partner is here." And I went back the next day, and they said, "Oh, yes, we'll give you a job," which was extraordinary. And we did a competition for a building on the Kudamm, which was actually won by Zaha. No, very early Zaha. This was, you know, it was extraordinary. Peter Cook was also competing. So it was kind of, you know, the presentation of the competition. There were these architectural luminaries that I was too, you know, I wasn't sufficiently connected to the world of architecture to realize how extraordinary these people were. So it was a fascinating experience. At that stage, Berlin was fascinating because it was half a city, and the very heart of the city, the Culture Forum, sat at what used to be the heart of pre-war Berlin, and yet was surrounded by wasteland and wall and platforms that people would go and climb on a Sunday afternoon and shout to their friends and relations in the east. Really extraordinary. And I guess what's been so fascinating is the way that the city has transformed, you know, very quickly after reunification. That central zone was healed with Potsdamer Platz, and you know, you go there today and it's almost eradicated that history. You know, it's amazing how fast architecture and urbanism can grow back and fill the void.
Is that a sort of criticism that it sort of perhaps erased too much of?
No, I think in that instance, I think the reunification, the end of the Cold War and the reunification of Germany was, you know, it was a globally significant challenge. And I think that sort of healing of the city was incredibly symbolic. Much as it's important to make history legible wherever we can, I think sometimes you also need to create a future, create the belief in a future that will be different.
And was there any sense when you were in Berlin of what was coming?
No. I was working on a site that was just by Checkpoint Charlie, hard up against the wall, within a block designed by Marta Elbogas Mackie from Barcelona. And we were doing a building within that block. And I can remember sitting in the IBA offices in Lindenstrasse with David Mackey, and as the two non-fluent German speakers, we would sit and sort of mutter to each other. And the instruction from the IBA was to design as if the wall was going to come down at some point. But even amongst the native Berliners, there was no sense that that was any time soon. And I think there was a real sense that if it came down, it would be the East engulfing. There was not an inkling that actually, you know, the Eastern Bloc would collapse, that you know, Western values would prevail. That was unimaginable. And yet it happened just a few years later. You know, it's quite extraordinary. And to walk along the facade of the building that sat, you know, 3 meters or 5 meters off the wall that I'd sat and drawn in Bartelsmann-Schmidt's office was fairly mind-bending.
So Field and Clegg Bradley played a very important part in your career. You spent a number of years there. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your time at that practice.
I joined when it was a practice of 10 or 12 people, based on the London Road in Bath, in sort of three Georgian ground floor and basement spaces, you know, a real rabbit warren. They were already pushing boundaries. They Richard and Peter were directors of a construction company. They'd pushed to allow architects to be developers. They were pioneers of sustainability in architecture. I think at the stage at which I joined, they had recently won a competition for a building for the Iona community that was quite a, you know, a significant milestone in the practice's evolution. We grew through small projects. You know, I cut my teeth on, I think the first project I delivered, my part three project, was a little building for a Camp Hill community in Ringwood that had a construction budget of £500,000. I drew everything. I designed all the furniture. It was a very, you know, very much a sort of arts and crafts approach to architecture. In terms of the other projects that I did there, really sort of significant to my development, National Trust headquarters, you know, thinking very hard about how to create something in a historic context. It sits in the Great Western Railway Works in Swindon alongside, you know, the remnants of Brunel's work there. Something that was pragmatically sustainable, and yet it's created a great robust environment that they've grown into and developed and you know, reworked, but fundamentally it's still working for them 20 odd years later. And finally, the Hive building in Worcester, that was a really visionary brief, visionary aspirations, fantastic client, delivered through PFI, which I had up until that point studiously kind of stepped away from because I, you know, I realise it's fiscally completely irresponsible. But I saw the brief and just thought, I really want to, I want to do this project. They'd used the National Trust headquarters as a reference project. So we approached Galliford Try as the sort of core team from that project. You know, the Hive had an aspiration to reduce carbon by 50%. It had a RAP target for use of recycled content. But it was also visionary in its aspiration for social inclusion. So it's all about creating a facility which is for the university and the city, which is bringing people in to deal with their housing problems to the Worcester City Council one-stop shop and giving them access to the biggest children's library in the UK and exposing the university library and essentially saying, this is for you. You can use any of this building. Galliford Try were amazing. They embraced a completely bonkers design, frankly, that was arrived at through an 18-month competitive dialogue process. Galliford's rolled with it and allowed Worcester to have the building that they wanted. The dialogue sessions were all played with very strict poker faces. So it was very difficult to read. And yet we had a real sense that I'm sure they really want our building.
So you've been at Perkins and Will for 4 months now.
Yes.
What made you make that move? And Are there any sort of parallels between what you're doing here and the work that you did at Arup?
Yeah, I loved my time at Arup. I had 8 years at Arup. I had a fantastic team in London, and there's a great global team. And I delivered, you know, a fair amount of the sort of initial ambition. And last summer, I got an approach from Perkins and Will saying, would you be interested in talking about this role? And essentially, they were looking for someone to do something similar, to come in and support the evolution of the team in London. There was no way I was looking, but actually I got drawn into the conversation and thought, oh, you know, this is an opportunity to do the same thing again. I've realized I quite like the kind of management consultant aspect of what I've been doing, of sort of looking under the bonnet and thinking, okay, what's going on here in terms of the dynamics of the business, the dynamics of the relationships? What do we need to do to make this work better? With regret, I walked away from Arup. And it was incredibly hard to walk away from a team that I'd kind of built that team. There are some fantastic people. And yeah, you know, that was really tough. And I think one of the aspects of that was that I'd heard a number of great people, particularly women. I mean, I completely diversified the team, including at senior levels. At senior levels, we were 50-50 when I left. And those women found it very tough that I was walking away. I'm really hoping that amongst them are people who are the future leaders of that practice. But yeah, I couldn't quite resist another challenge. You know, I've joined this business at a really interesting time. You know, I'd heard of Perkins and Will. I really didn't know that we are the second largest architecture practice globally. No, Perkins and Will is a great business that actually has many parallels with Arup, with Field and Clegg, in terms of a focus on social infrastructure, huge focus on sustainability. Yeah, those are the really driving principles of the US practice. I don't think the London team had particularly embraced that US approach. And I think what we're doing now, you know, the moves we're making are about bringing that ethos to London. So I think my challenge is to get the different parts of the business integrated back to that whole that is greater than the sum of its parts, and to introduce the London market to what Perkins and Will stands for as architects alongside the interiors practice.
You wrote a comment piece for BD recently, talking about office culture, how you introduce graduates into the workplace, and talking about the whole sort of digital nature of work.
Digital has been a huge, it's a huge challenge and a huge opportunity for our industry. The challenge is that people of my generation who are in leadership roles now grew up in an analog world. No, I drew my final scheme in pencil on film. We're now bringing people into the workplace who are digital natives, who have no qualms, no preconceptions. They're just completely familiar with the digital world. There is a huge divide that I think is going to take another 10 or 15 years to work its way through, until the people who are in leadership roles are digital natives. And so we are trying to create a climate where we can really exploit digital to offer amazing services, to deliver efficiently, to de-risk, to explore new opportunities. No, we are not fluent in all of those tools. And I think that's a hugely difficult thing.
The pace of change,
the challenges of new technology, the opportunities and the cost of those opportunities, the learning time, the kind of getting up to speed. In my early days at Arup, we were working on a hugely complicated, geometrically complex Middle East project, trying to do it in Revit, creating models that were too complex, that were too big, that were too unmaneuverable, using systems that just weren't quite up to that level of complexity. And the impact on teams was just so painful to watch, because, you know, there were people sitting there crying at 3 o'clock in the morning, watching a wheel spin while a model failed to upload because it was just too clunky. people have been scrabbling up this learning curve, which sometimes feels like a sheer cliff face. And that's been tough. But, you know, we're getting there. We're moving, you know, we're kind of progressing.
I thought one of the really interesting things that you mentioned in your comment piece for BD was this issue around practices having their own language and the need for firms to educate or sort of upskill, or however you want to sort of phrase it, those new arrivals into the firm, into how you work and the language that you use.
Yeah, I think it's, again, it's a learning piece from Arup, who are very organized about bringing in grads because they're bringing in 250 grads or 400 grads each year. And therefore, there is a big machine that is about educating those people. I've basically advocated that we do something similar. We're going to be bringing in a number of grads across the different parts of the business. And actually, you know, we could bring them in haphazardly and allow each one of them to find their way. And eventually, after 3 months or 6 months or, you know, or longer or never, they will kind of work out how we work. Or we do it in a systematic way. We accept that they come with different levels of awareness, and we actually put them through a program of the baseline skills. It also has an advantage of creating a team, allowing those grads to feel that they have mates going through the same process. And I think there are advantages to that. So it's adopting a big practice mindset to something which I think previously here probably worked as a series of small practice mindsets.
There's a project that the practice has been working on, Lancaster West Estate Refurb, that's a co-design and refurb project. I was wondering if you'd like to tell us a little bit more about that. I thought it was interesting because it's, I believe, in Kensington and Chelsea, the borough where the Grenfell tragedy took place. It's working very much with the residents, and it's a refurbishment, not a replacement of that estate.
It is a project that fits very well with the kind of Panur and Prasad ethos, and it's Rafi Marks has led it, who's one of the Panur and Prasad directors. No, it sits comfortably within that portfolio. I think it's been a very challenging project for a number of reasons. Obviously, dealing with co-creation with that community that has suffered so much, but the outcome looks great, and there's clearly a lot of positivity around it. And, you know, I would like to think that kind of community architecture will have a place in our portfolio.
If you had to make three suggestions for improving the quality of placemaking in the UK, what would they be?
I think we need to face up to carbon reduction and its place in placemaking, and look at the checks and balances. How do we drive everything that we do, but not just on an individual building basis, but if we're looking at larger scale development, how do we legislate to achieve carbon reduction targets? It would be great to see government adopting an approach to whole life carbon, and, you know, maybe setting targets on a place basis, which allows you to sort of balance out across different typologies. You know, there's an advantage there. There's opportunities in operational energy and in embodied energy to look at different types of buildings and their carbon footprint. But, you know, if we could define what an affordable level of carbon is, and then incentivize or penalize, you know, whether there's taxation, whether there's, you know, there must be a mechanism to drive development towards those targets. It needs a government fluent in carbon. You've obviously got to set goals which are attainable, but they should be tough. And I think, you know, the built environment is not doing its bit. We are not doing well enough. Other sectors are doing better. We need to find a way of incentivizing progression towards a more circular economy. Again, it's too easy to go, too difficult. Oh, development is very complex. Creating incentives which drive supply chains to accelerate the change. You know, that's what we've got to do. Otherwise, we will never get there. The other sort of aspect of the industry that worries me most at the moment is how completely screwed up the UK housing market is. If you look at availability of affordable housing, and there must be a legislative route to diverse housing. Let's get a properly integrated world where people can live in, you know, people can be secure. You know, that's how you create great places.
Thanks, Jo. That was a really fascinating insight into your thoughts and approaches to placemaking and practice. I'd just like to wrap up now with a few sort of more lighthearted questions. I'm going to be asking all of these questions to the interviewees on the podcast series. And the first is around somewhere that sort of really inspires you. I think we all have an idea of what makes a good place. It often sort of relates to where we've lived or places that we've visited. Can you just name one place that's made a really big impact on you?
Well, I mean, it sounds a little trite, but Bath is an extraordinary city. It was revolutionary in its day, but the materiality, the detail, the embracing the topography just has created something which has fabulous quality and longevity. The buildings are adaptable, resilient, support health and well-being, great daylight, great natural ventilation. There's a whole lot of ingredients there that we could really learn from in creating contemporary places.
So my second question, I've sort of termed it the Poundbury question, but it's not really intended to be a sort of a provocation. It's really to ask why there aren't more good examples of contemporary sort of architectural town extensions that deliver the mix that we see at Poundbury with the sort of walkability, the high levels of employment provided within that development. I was just wondering if you could sort of talk around that sort of question.
I think it's incredibly sad that the go-to example of a successful integrated place where, you know, livability, quality of environment, actually appear to be working, has adopted the sort of clothes of pastiche. And it's easy to muddy the perception that the pastiche is what's driving success. Why doesn't it work elsewhere? I think it's probably down to development economics and the cycle of return on investment. To create a total environment of quality requires a longer term view. And too much of our industry is focused on short term gains. The need to see a return more quickly. I suspect if, to replicate the positive characteristics of Poundbury elsewhere needs a developer who is farsighted and who is willing to take their return over a longer duration.
Okay, Jo, last question. Could you name somebody in the industry who you think's been making a really positive impact on placemaking? Doesn't need to be an architect, could be anybody.
It's not so much in the moment, but I think what Ricky Burdett did in setting up the Cities Programme was really visionary. It's had a huge influence globally, actually, on the way that people think about that, the interface between architecture and urbanism, economics and social policy. And it's a complicated, rich, diverse challenge. And the more people who are educated and upskilled in thinking about those issues holistically, the better. Now, I think historically architecture was very kind of, it was viewed as an art. I don't think it's an art, I think it's a science. And I think it's about how do you put all of the ingredients together in a way that is holistically sustainable, socially, economically, and environmentally.
Joe, thanks so much. It's been wonderful getting to know you and getting this insight into how you work. So thanks again, and good luck with your future projects.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
You've been listening to the Building Talks Creating Communities podcast with me, Chloe McCulloch, and Ben Flatman. Our next episode is out on Tuesday. In the meantime, you can find out more about the Building the Future Commission at building.co.uk and more about urban design issues at our sister title, bdonline.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.